putting out the candle, the priest said, "I suppose I needn't say this, but if you build a fire near the temple, as those men did earlier, please be careful and extinguish it when you leave." "I'll do so without fail." "Very well, then. Please excuse me." The priest went back through the gate and shut it. The man on the veranda stood still for a time, looking intently toward Denshichiro.
"Kyosuke, who is it?"
"I can't tell, but he came from the kitchen.
He doesn't seem to belong to the temple."
The two of them walked about 20 paces nearer the building. The shadowy man moved to a point near the middle of the veranda, stopped, and tied up his sleeve. The men in the courtyard unconsciously approached close enough to see this, but then their feet refused to go any nearer. After an interval of 2 or 3 breaths, Denshichiro shouted,
"Musashi!"
He was well aware that the man standing several feet above him was in a very advantageous position. Not only was he perfectly safe from the rear, but anyone trying to attack him from either the right or the left would first have to climb up to his level. He was thus free to devote his entire attention to the enemy before him. Behind Denshichiro was open ground, snow, and wind. He felt sure Musashi would not bring anyone with him, but he could not afford to ignore the wide space to his rear. He made a motion as though brushing something off his kimono and said urgently to Kyosuke,
"Get away from here!"
Kyosuke moved to the back edge of the courtyard.
"Are you ready?"
Musashi's question was calm but trenchant, falling like so much ice water on his opponent's feverish excitement. Denshichiro now got his first good look at Musashi.
"So this is the bastard," he thought.
His hatred was total. He resented the maiming of his brother, he was vexed at being compared with Musashi by the common people, and he had an ingrained contempt for what he regarded as a country upstart posing as a samurai.
"Who are you to ask? Are you ready? It's well past the hour of 9.
"Did I say I'd be here exactly at 9?
"Don't make excuses. I've been waiting a long time. As you can see, I'm fully prepared. Now come down from there."
He did not underestimate his opponent to the extent of daring to attack from his present position.
"In a minute,"
answered Musashi with a slight laugh. There was a difference between Musashi's idea of preparation and his opponent's. Denshichiro, though physically prepared, had only begun to pull himself together spiritually, whereas Musashi had started fighting long before he presented himself to his enemy. For him, the battle was now entering its second and central phase. At the Gion Shrine, he had seen the footprints in the snow, and at that moment his fighting instinct had been aroused. Knowing that the shadow of the man following him was no longer there, he had boldly entered the front gate of the Rengeoin and made a quick approach to the kitchen. Having wakened the priest, he struck up a conversation, subtly questioning the man as to what had been going on earlier in the evening. Disregarding the fact that he was a little late, he had had some tea and warmed himself. Then, when he made his appearance, it was abrupt and from the relative safety of the veranda. He had seized the initiative. His second opportunity came in the form of Denshichiro's attempt to draw him out. One way of fighting would be to accept this. The other would be to ignore it and create an opening of his own. Caution was in order. In a case like this, victory is like the moon reflected on a lake. If one jumps for it impulsively, one can drown. Denshichiro's exasperation knew no bounds.
"Not only are you late," he shouted, "you aren't ready, and I haven't got a decent footing here."
Musashi, still perfectly calm, replied,
"I'm coming. Just a minute."
Denshichiro did not have to be told that anger could result in defeat, but in the face of this deliberate effort to annoy him, he was unable to control his emotions. The lessons he had learned in strategy deserted him.
"Come down," he screamed. "Here into the courtyard. Let's stop the tricks and fight bravely. I am Yoshioka Denshichiro, and I have nothing but spit for makeshift tactics or cowardly attacks. If you're frightened before the match begins, you're not qualified to confront me. Get down from there!
Musashi grinned.
Yoshioka Denshichiro, eh? What do I have to fear from you? I cut you in half in the spring of last year, so if I do it again tonight, it's only repeating what I've done before.
What are you talking about? Where? When?
At Koyagyu, in Yamato.
Yamato?
In the bath at the Wataya Inn, to be exact.
Were you there?
I was. We were both naked, of course, but with my eyes, I calculated whether I could cut you down or not. And with my eyes, I slew you then and there, in rather splendid fashion, if I may say so myself. You probably didn't notice, because there were no scars left on your body, but you were defeated, no question about it. Other people may be willing to listen to you brag about your ability as a swordsman, but from me, you'll get nothing but a laugh. I was curious as to how you'd talk, and now I know, like an idiot. But your babbling intrigues me. Come down from there, and I'll open your conceited eyes for you. What's your weapon? Sword? Wooden sword?
Why ask when you don't have a wooden sword? You came expecting to use a sword, didn't you?
I did. But I thought if you wanted to use a wooden sword, I'd take yours away from you and fight with that.
I don't have one, you fool! Enough big talk! Fight!
Ready?
No!
Denshichiro's heels made a black slanted line about 9 feet long as he opened a space for Musashi to land in. Musashi quickly sidestepped 20 or 30 feet along the veranda before jumping down. Then, when they had moved, swords sheathed, eyeing each other warily, about 200 feet from the temple, Denshichiro lost his head. Abruptly, he drew and swung. His sword was long, just the right size for his body. Making only a slight whistling sound, it went through the air with amazing lightness, straight to the spot where Musashi had been standing. Musashi was faster than the sword. Even quicker was the springing of the glittering blade from his own scabbard. It looked as though they were too close together for both of them to emerge unscathed, but after a moment of dancing reflected light from the swords, they backed off. Several tense minutes passed. The two combatants were silent and motionless, swords stationary in the air, point aimed at point, but separated by a distance of about 9 feet. The snow piled on Denshichiro's brow dropped to his eyelashes. To shake it off, he contorted his face until his forehead muscles looked like countless moving bumps. His bulging eyeballs glowed like the windows of a melting furnace, and the exhalations of his deep, steady breathing were as hot and gusty as those from a bellows. Desperation had entered his thinking, for he realized how bad his position was. Why am I holding the sword at eye level when I always hold it above my head for the attack? He asked himself. He was not thinking in the ordinary sense of the word. His very blood, palpitating audibly through his veins, told him that. But his whole body, down to his toenails, was concentrated in an effort to present an image of ferocity to the enemy. The knowledge that the eye-level stance was not one in which he excelled nagged him. Any number of times he itched to raise his elbows and get the sword above his head, but it was too risky. Musashi was on the alert for just such an opening, that tiny fraction of a second when his vision would be blocked by his arms. Musashi held his sword at eye-level too, with his elbows relaxed, flexible and capable of movement in any direction. Denshichiro's arms, held in an unaccustomed stance, were tight and rigid, and his sword unsteady. Musashi's was absolutely still. Snow began to pile up on its thin upper edge. As he watched hawk-like for the slightest slip on his opponent's part, Musashi counted the number of times he breathed. He not only wanted to win, he had to win. He was acutely conscious of once again standing on the borderline, on one side life, on the other death. He saw Denshiro as a gigantic boulder, an overpowering presence. The name of the god of war, Hachiman, passed through his mind.
His technique is better than mine, Musashi thought candidly.
He had had the same feeling of inferiority at Koyagyu Castle when he had been encircled by the four leading swordsmen of the Yagyu school. It was always this way when he faced swordsmen of the orthodox schools, for his own technique was without form or reason, nothing more, really, than a do-or-die method. Staring at Denshiro, he saw that the style Yoshioka Kenpo had created and spent his life developing had both simplicity and complexity, was well-ordered and systematic, and was not to be overcome by brute strength or spirit alone. Musashi was cautious about making any unnecessary movements. His primitive tactics refused to come into play. To an extent, that surprised him. His arms rebelled against being extended. The best he could do was to maintain a conservative, defensive stance and wait. His eyes grew red, searching for an opening, and he prayed to Hachiman for victory. With swelling excitement, his heart began to race. If he had been an ordinary man, he might have been sucked into a whirlpool of confusion and succumbed. Yet he remained steady, shaking off his sense of inadequacy as if it were no more than snow on his sleeve. His ability to control this new exhilaration was the result of having already survived several brushes with death. His spirit was fully awake now, as though a veil had been removed from before his eyes. Dead silence. Snow accumulated on Musashi's hair, on Denshiro's shoulders. Musashi no longer saw a great boulder before him. He himself no longer existed as a separate person. The will to win had been forgotten. He saw the whiteness of the snow falling between himself and the other man, and the spirit of the snow was as light as his own. The space now seemed an extension of his own body. He had become the universe, or the universe had become him. He was there, yet not there. Denshiro's feet inched forward. At the tip of his sword, his willpower quivered toward the start of a movement. Two lives expired with two strokes of a single sword. First, Musashi attacked to his rear, and Otaguro Hyosuke's head, or a piece of it, sailed past Musashi like a great crimson cherry, as the body staggered lifelessly toward Denshiro. The second horrendous scream, Denshiro's cry of attack, was cut short midway, the broken-off sound thinning out into the space around them. Musashi leapt so high that he appeared to have sprung from the level of his opponent's chest. Denshiro's big frame reeled backward and dropped in a spray of white snow. Body pitifully bent, face buried in the snow, the dying man cried, "Wait! Wait!" Musashi was no longer there.
"Hear that? It's Denshiro! He's been hurt!"
The black forms of Genzaemon and the Yoshioka disciples rushed across the courtyard like a wave.
"Look! Kyosuke's been killed! Denshiro! Denshiro!"
Yet they knew there was no use calling, no use thinking about medical treatment. Kyosuke's head had been sliced sideways from the right ear to the middle of the mouth, Denshiro's from the top down to the right cheekbone, all in a matter of seconds.
That's why I warned you, sputtered Genzaemon. That's why I told you not to take him lightly. Oh, Denshiro! Denshiro!
The old man hugged his nephew's body, trying in vain to console it. Genzaemon clung to Denshiro's corpse, but it angered him to see the others milling about in the blood-reddened snow.
What happened to Musashi?
He thundered. Some had already started searching. They saw no sign of Musashi.
He's not here,
came the answer, timid and obtuse.
He's around somewhere, barked Genzaemon. He hasn't got wings. If I don't get in a blow of revenge, I can never again hold my head up as a member of the Yoshioka family. Find him!
One man gasped and pointed. The others fell back a pace and stared in the direction indicated.
It's Musashi! Musashi!
As the idea sank in, silence filled the air. Not the tranquility of a place of worship, but an ominous, diabolical silence as though ears, eyes, and brains had ceased to function. Whatever the man had seen, it was not Musashi, for Musashi was standing under the eaves of the nearest building. His eyes fixed on the Yoshioka men and his back pressed to the wall, he edged his way along until he reached the southwest corner of the Sanju Sangendo. He climbed onto the veranda and crept, slowly and quietly, to the center.
"Will they attack?"
he asked himself. When they made no move in his direction, he continued stealthily on to the north side of the building and, with a bound, disappeared into the darkness. The Elegant People.
"No impudent nobleman's going to get the best of me. If he thinks he can put me off by sending a blank piece of paper, I'll just have to have a word with him. And I'll bring Yoshino back, if only for the sake of my pride."
It is said that one need not be young to enjoy playing games. When Hiya Shoyu was in his cups, there was no holding him back.
"Take me to their room," he ordered Sumigiku.
He put a hand on her shoulder to prop himself into a standing position. In vain, Koetsu admonished him to be calm.
"No, I'm going to get Yoshino. Standard bearers, ho! Your general is moving into action. Those with heart, follow!"
A peculiar characteristic of the inebriated is that, though they appear to be in constant danger of falling or suffering some worse mishap, if left alone, they usually escape harm. Still, if no one took measures to protect them, it would be a cold world indeed. With all his years of experience, Shoyu was able to draw a fine line between amusing himself and entertaining others. When they thought him tipsy enough to be easy to handle, he would contrive to be as difficult as possible, staggering and tottering until someone came to his rescue, at which point there would be a meeting of spirits on the boundary where drunkenness evokes sympathetic response.
"You fall!" cried Sumigiku, rushing to prevent this. "Don't be silly! My legs may wobble a bit, but my spirit's firm!"
He sounded peevish. "Try walking alone." She let go, and he immediately slumped to the floor.
"I guess I'm a little tired. Someone will have to carry me."
On the way to Lord Kangan's parlor, appearing to know nothing, yet perfectly conscious of everything, he staggered, swayed, turned into jelly, and otherwise kept his companions on edge from one end of the long hallway to the other. At stake was whether or not insolent, half-baked noblemen, as he called them, were going to monopolize Yoshino Dayu. The great merchants, who were nothing more than rich commoners, did not stand in awe of the emperor's courtiers. True, they were appallingly rank-conscious, but this counted for little because they had no money. By spreading around enough gold to keep them happy, participating in their elegant pastimes, making a show of deference to their status, and allowing them to maintain their pride, it was possible to manipulate them like puppets. No one knew this better than Shoyu. Light danced gaily on the shoji of the anteroom to Lord Karasumaru's parlor as Shoyu fumbled to open it. Abruptly, the door was opened from inside.
"Why, Shoyu, it's you!"
exclaimed Takuan Soho. Shoyu's eyes widened, first in astonishment, then in delight.
"Good priest!" he sputtered. "What a pleasant surprise! Have you been here all along?"
"And you, good sir, have you been here all along?" mimicked Takuan.
He put his arm around Shoyu's neck, and the two drunkenly embraced like a pair of lovers, cheek against doubled cheek.
"Are you well, you old scoundrel?"
"Yes, you old fraud. And you?"
"I've been hoping to see you."
"And I you."
Before the maudlin greeting had run its course, the two were patting each other on the head and licking each other on the nose. Lord Karasumaru turned his attention from the anteroom to Lord Konoe Nobutada, who sat opposite him, and said with a sardonic grin,
"Ha! Just as I expected! The noisy one has arrived!"
Karasumaru Mitsuhiro was still young, perhaps 30. Even without his impeccable dress, he would have had an aristocratic air about him, for he was handsome and light-complexioned, with thick eyebrows, crimson lips, and intelligent eyes. While he gave the impression of being a very gentle man, beneath the polished surface lurked a strong temper, fed by pent-up resentment against the military class. Often he had been heard to say, "Why, in this age, when only the warriors are deemed to be full-fledged human beings, did I have to be born a nobleman?" In his opinion, the warrior class should concern itself with military matters and nothing else, and any young courtier with intelligence who did not bridle at the current state of affairs was a fool. The warrior's assumption of absolute control reversed the ancient principle that government should be carried on by the imperial court with the aid of the military. The samurai no longer made any attempt to maintain harmony with the nobility. They ran everything, treating members of the court as though they were mere ornaments. Not only were the ornate headdresses the courtiers were allowed to wear meaningless, but the decisions they were allowed to make could have been made by dolls. Lord Karasumaru considered it a grave mistake on the part of the gods to have made a man like himself a nobleman. And though a servant of the emperor, he saw only two paths open to him: to live in constant misery, or to spend his time carousing. The sensible choice was to rest his head on the knees of a beautiful woman, admire the pale light of the moon, view the cherry blossoms in season, and die with a cup of sake in his hand. Having advanced from Imperial Minister of Finance to Assistant Vice Minister of the Right, and then to Imperial Counselor, he was a high official in the emperor's impotent bureaucracy, but he spent a great deal of time in the licensed quarter, where the atmosphere was conducive to forgetting the insults he had to endure when attending to more practical affairs. Among his habitual companions were several other disgruntled young noblemen, all of them poor in comparison with the military rulers, but somehow able to raise the money for their nightly excursions to the Ogia, the only place, they averred, where they were free to feel human. Tonight, he had as his guest a man of another sort, the taciturn, well-mannered Konoe Nobutada, who was about 10 years older. Nobutada, too, had an aristocratic demeanor and a grave look in his eyes. His face was full and his eyebrows thick, and though his darkish complexion was marred by shallow pockmarks, the pleasant modesty of the man made the blemishes seem somehow appropriate. In places like the Ogia, an outsider would never have guessed he was one of Kyoto's highest-ranking noblemen, the head of the family from which imperial regents were chosen. Smiling affably by Yoshino's side, he turned to her and said, "That's Mr. Funabashi's voice, isn't it?" She bit her lips, already redder than plum blossoms, and her eyes betrayed embarrassment at the awkwardness of the situation. "What shall I do if he comes in?" she fretted. Lord Karasumaru commanded, "Don't stand up!" and grasped the hem of her kimono. "Takuan, what are you doing out there? It's cold with the door open. If you're going out, go. And if you're coming back, come back. But close the door." Swallowing the bait, Takuan said to Shoyu, "Come on in," and pulled the old man into the room. Shoyu walked over and sat down directly in front of the two noblemen.
"My, what a pleasant surprise,"
exclaimed Mitsuhiro with feigned sincerity. Shoyu, on his bony knees, edged closer. Sticking his hand out toward Nobutada, he said, "Give me some sake!" Having received the cup, he bowed with exaggerated ceremony.
"Good to see you, old man Funabashi," said Nobutada with a grin. "You always seem to be in high spirits."
Shoyu drained the cup and returned it.
"I didn't dream that Lord Kangan's companion was Your Excellency."
Still pretending to be drunker than he actually was, he shook his thin, wrinkled neck like an ancient manservant and said in mock fear,
"Forgive me, esteemed Excellency."
Then in a different tone,
"Why should I be so polite? Ha ha! Isn't that so, Takuan?"
He put his arm around Takuan's neck, pulled the priest toward him, and pointed a finger at the two courtiers.
"Takuan," he said, "the people in this world I feel sorriest for are the noblemen. They bear resounding titles like counselor or regent, but there's nothing to go with the honors. Even the merchants are better off, don't you think?"
"I do indeed,"
replied Takuan, contriving to disengage his neck.
"Say," said Shoyu, placing a cup directly beneath the priest's nose, "I haven't received a drink from you yet."
Takuan poured him some sake. The old man drank.
"You're a wily man, Takuan. In the world we live in, priests like you are cunning, merchants smart, warriors strong, and noblemen stupid."
"Ha ha! Isn't that so?"
It is," agreed Takuan. "The noblemen can't do as they please because of their rank, but they're shut out of politics and the government. So all that's left for them to do is compose poetry or become experts at calligraphy. Isn't that the truth?"
He laughed again. Though Mitsuhiro and Nobutada were as fond of fun as Shoyu, the bluntness of the ridicule was embarrassing. They responded with stony silence. Taking advantage of their discomfort, Shoyu pressed on.
"Yoshino, what do you think? Do you fancy noblemen, or do you prefer merchants?"
"Hee-hee," tittered Yoshino. "Why, Mr. Funabashi, what a strange question."
"I'm not joking. I'm trying to peer deep into a woman's heart. Now, I can see what's there. You really prefer merchants, don't you? I think I'd better take you away from here. Come with me to my parlor."
He took her by the hand and stood up, a shrewd look on his face. Mitsuhiro, startled, spilled his sake.
"A joke can be carried too far,"
he said, yanking Yoshino's hand from Shoyu's and pulling her closer to his side. Caught between the two, Yoshino laughed and tried to make the best of it. Taking Mitsuhiro's hand in her right hand and Shoyu's in her left, she put on a worried look and said,
"What am I ever going to do with you two?"
For the two men, though they neither disliked each other nor were serious rivals in love, the rules of the game dictated that they do everything in their power to make Yoshino Dayu's position more embarrassing.
"Come now, my good lady," said Shoyu. "You must decide for yourself. You must choose the man whose room you will grace, the one to whom you will give your heart."
Takuan jumped into the fray.
"A very interesting problem, isn't it? Tell us, Yoshino, which one is your choice?"
The only person not participating was Nobutada. After a time, his sense of propriety moved him to say,
"Come now, you're guests. Don't be rude. The way you're acting, I dare say Yoshino would be delighted to be rid of you both. Why don't we all enjoy ourselves and stop bothering her? Koetsu must be all by himself. One of you girls go and invite him to come here."
Shoyu waved his hand.
"No reason to fetch him. I'll just go back to my room with Yoshino."
"You will not,"
said Mitsuhiro, hugging her tighter.
"The insolence of the aristocracy,"
exclaimed Shoyu. Eyes sparkling, he offered Mitsuhiro a cup, saying,
"Let's decide who gets her by holding a drinking contest right before her eyes."
"Why, of course. That sounds like good fun."
Mitsuhiro took a large cup and placed it on a small table between them.
"Are you sure you're young enough to stand it?"
he asked playfully.
Don't have to be young to compete with a skinny nobleman. How are we going to decide whose turn it is? It's no fun just swilling. We should play a game. Whoever loses has to drink a cupful. What game shall we play? We could try staring each other down. That would involve looking at your ugly merchant's face. That's not play. It's torture.
Don't be insulting. How about the stone-scissor-paper game?
Fine. Takuan, you be referee.
Anything to oblige.
With earnest faces, they began. After each round, the loser complained with appropriate bitterness, and everyone laughed. Yoshino Dayu slipped quietly out of the room, gracefully trailing the bottom of her long kimono behind her, and walked at a stately pace down the hallway. Not long after she left, Konoe Nobutada said, "I must go too," and took his leave unnoticed. Yawning shamelessly, Takuan lay down and without so much as a "by your leave," rested his head on Sumigiku's knee. Though it felt good to doze here, he also felt a pang of guilt.
"I should go home," he thought. "They're probably lonely without me."
He was thinking of Jotaro and Otsu, who were together again at Lord Karasumaru's house. Takuan had taken Otsu there after her ordeal at Kiyomizudera. Takuan and Lord Karasumaru were old friends, with many interests in common: poetry, zen, drinking, even politics. Toward the end of the previous year, Takuan had received a letter inviting him to spend the New Year's holidays in Kyoto.
"You seem to be cooped up in a little temple in the country," Mitsuhiro wrote. "Don't you long for the capital? For some good nada sake? For the company of beautiful women? For the sight of the little plovers by the Kamo River? If you like to sleep, I suppose it's all right to practice your zen in the country. But if you want something more lively, then come here and be among people. Should you feel any nostalgia for the capital, by all means pay us a visit."
Shortly after his arrival, early in the new year, Takuan was quite surprised to see Jotaro playing in the courtyard. He learned in detail from Mitsuhiro what the boy was doing there, and then heard from Jotaro that there had been no news of Otsu since Osugi got her clutches into the girl on New Year's Day. The morning after her return, Otsu had come down with a fever, and she was still in bed, with Jotaro nursing her, sitting by her pillow all day, cooling her forehead with wet towels and measuring out her medicine at the proper times of the day. As much as Takuan wanted to leave, he could hardly do so before his host did, and Mitsuhiro seemed to be more and more absorbed in the drinking contest. Both combatants being veterans, the contest seemed destined to end in a draw, which it did. They went on drinking anyway, facing each other knee to knee and chatting animatedly. Takuan could not tell whether the subject was government by the military class, the inherent worth of the nobility, or the role of merchants in the development of foreign trade, but evidently it was something very serious. He lifted his head from Sumigiku's knee and, eyes still closed, leaned against a post of the alcove, every once in a while grinning at a snatch of conversation. Presently, Mitsuhiro asked in an injured tone,
"Where's Nobutada? Did he go home?" "Never mind him. Where's Yoshino?"
Shoyu asked, suddenly looking quite sober. Mitsuhiro told Rinya to go and bring Yoshino back. As she passed the room where Shoyu and Koetsu had started out the evening, Rinya looked in. Musashi was sitting there alone, his face next to the white light of the lamp.
"Why, I didn't know you were back," said Rinya.
"I haven't been here long."
"Did you come in by the back way?"
"Yes."
"Where did you go?"
Outside the district."
"I bet you had an engagement with a beautiful girl. Shame on you. Shame on you. I'm going to tell my mistress," she said saucily.
Musashi laughed.
"No one's here," he said. "What happened to them?"
"They're in another room, playing games with Lord Kangang and a priest."
"Koetsu too?"
"No, I don't know where he is."
"Maybe he went home. If he did, I should go too."
"You mustn't say that. When you come to this house, you can't leave without Yoshino Dayu's consent. If you just sneak away, people will laugh at you, and I'll be scolded.
Not being attuned to the humor of the courtesans, he received this news with serious countenance, thinking,
"So that's the way they do things here."
"You absolutely mustn't go without taking your leave properly. Just wait here until I come back."
A few minutes later, Takuan appeared.
"And where did you come from?"
he asked, with a tap on the ronin's shoulder.
"What?"
gasped Musashi. Slipping off his cushion, he put both hands on the floor and bowed deeply.
"What a long time since I saw you last."
Lifting Musashi's hands from the floor, Takuan said,
"This place is for fun and relaxation. No need for formal greetings. I was told Koetsu was here too, but I don't see him."
"Where do you suppose he could have gone?"
"Let's find him. I do have a number of things to talk to you about privately, but they can wait until a more suitable occasion."
Takuan opened the door into the next room. There, with his feet in the covered kotatsu and a quilt over him, lay Koetsu, sequestered from the rest of the room by a small gold screen. He was sleeping peacefully. Takuan could not bring himself to wake him. Koetsu opened his eyes of his own accord. He stared for a moment at the priest's face, then at Musashi's, not quite knowing what to make of it. After they had explained the situation to him, Koetsu said,
"If it's only you and Mitsuhiro in the other room, I have no objection to going there."
They found that Mitsuhiro and Shoyu, having finally talked themselves out, had sunk into melancholy. They had reached the stage where the sake begins to taste bitter, the lips feel parched, and a sip of water evokes thoughts of home. Tonight, the after effects were worse. Yoshino had deserted them.
"Why don't we all go home?" someone suggested.
"We might as well," agreed the others.
Though not really eager to leave, they were afraid that if they stayed longer, nothing would be left of the evening's mellowness. But as they stood up to go, Rinya came running into the room with two younger girls. Clasping Lord Kangan's hands, Rinya said,
"We're sorry to have kept you waiting. Please don't leave. Yoshino Dayu is ready to receive you in her private quarters. I know it's late, but it's light outside, because of the snow. And in this cold, you should at least warm yourselves properly before getting in your palanquins. Come with us."
None of them felt like playing anymore. The spirit, once gone, was difficult to summon back. Noting their hesitation, one of the attendants said,
"Yoshino said she was sure you all thought her rude for leaving, but she saw nothing else to do. If she gave in to Lord Kangan, Mr. Funabashi would be hurt, and if she went away with Mr. Funabashi, Lord Kangan would be lonesome. She doesn't want either of you to feel slighted, so she's inviting you for a nightcap. Please understand how she feels, and stay a little longer."
Sensing that a refusal would be ungallant, and more than a little curious to see the leading courtesan in her own living quarters, they allowed themselves to be persuaded. Guided by the girls, they found five pairs of rustic straw sandals at the top of the garden steps. Donning these, they made their way soundlessly across the soft snow. Musashi had no idea of what was going on, but the others assumed they were to take part in the tea ceremony, for Yoshino was known to be an ardent devotee of the tea cult. Since there was something to be said for a bowl of tea after all the drinking they had done, no one was upset until they were led on past the tea house and into an overgrown field.
"Where are you taking us?" asked Lord Kangan in an accusing tone. "This is a mulberry patch."
The girls giggled, and Rinya hastened to explain.
"Oh no, this is our peony garden. In the early summer, we put out stools, and everybody comes here to drink and admire the blossoms."
"Mulberry patch or peony garden, it's not very pleasant being out here in the snow. Is Yoshino trying to make us catch cold?"
"I'm sorry, it's only a little farther."
In the corner of the field was a little cottage with a thatched roof, which, from the looks of it, was probably a farmhouse that had been here since before the area was built up. There was a grove of trees behind it, and the yard was cut off from the well-cared-for garden of the Ogia.
"This way,"
urged the girls, leading them into a dirt-floored room whose walls and posts were black with soot. Rinya announced their arrival, and from the interior, Yoshino Dayu answered,
"Welcome. Please, come in."
The fire in the hearth cast a soft red glow on the shoji paper. The atmosphere seemed utterly remote from the city. As the men looked around the kitchen and noticed straw rain capes hanging on one wall, they wondered what sort of entertainment Yoshino had planned for them. The shoji slid open, and one by one they stepped up into the hearth room. Yoshino's kimono was a pale, solid yellow, her obi of black satin. She wore the minimum of makeup and had rearranged her hair into a simple, housewifely style. Her guests stared at her with admiration.
"How unusual! How charming!"
In her unpretentious outfit, set off by the blackened walls, Yoshino was 100 times more beautiful than she was in the elaborately embroidered Momoyama-style costumes she wore at other times. The gaudy kimonos the men were accustomed to, the iridescent lipstick, and the setting of gold screens and silver candlesticks were necessary for a woman in her business. But Yoshino had no need for props to enhance her beauty.
"Hmm," said Shoyu, "this is something quite special."
Not one to offer praise lightly, the old man with his acerbic tongue seemed temporarily tamed. Without spreading cushions, Yoshino invited them to sit down by the hearth.
"I live here, as you can see, and I can't offer you much, but at least there's a fire. I hope you agree, a fire is the most excellent feast one can present on a cold, snowy night, whether one's guest is prince or pauper. There's a good supply of kindling, so even if we talk the night out, I won't have to use the potted plants for fuel. Please, make yourselves comfortable."
The nobleman, the merchant, the artist, and the priest sat cross-legged by the hearth, with their hands over the fire. Koetsu reflected on the cold walk from the ogia and the invitation to the cheery fire. It actually was like a feast, the essence, really, of entertaining.
"You come up by the fire, too," said Yoshino.
She smiled invitingly at Musashi and moved slightly to make a place for him. Musashi was struck by the exalted company he was in. Next to Toyotomi Hideyoshi and Tokugawa Ieyasu, she was probably the most famous person in Japan. Of course, there was Okuni of Kabuki fame and Hideyoshi's mistress, Yodogimi, but Yoshino was regarded as having more class than the former and more wit, beauty, and kindness than the latter. The men who associated with Yoshino were known as the buyers, while she herself was called the Tayu. Any courtesan of the first class was known as Tayu, but to say the Tayu meant Yoshino and no one else. Musashi had heard that she had 7 attendants to bathe her and 2 to cut her nails. This evening, for the first time in his life, Musashi found himself in the company of painted and polished ladies, and he reacted by becoming stiffly formal. This was partly because he could not help wondering what men found so extraordinary about Yoshino.
"Please, relax," she said. "Come, sit here."
After the 4th or 5th invitation, he capitulated. Taking his place beside her, he imitated the others, extending his hands awkwardly over the fire. Yoshino glanced at his sleeve and saw a spot of red. While the others were immersed in conversation, she quietly took a piece of paper from her sleeve and wiped it off.
Thank you, said Musashi.
If he had remained silent, no one would have noticed, but the moment he spoke, every eye went to the crimson stain on the paper in Yoshino's hand. Opening his eyes wide, Mitsuhiro said,
"That's blood, isn't it?"
Yoshino smiled.
"No, of course not. It's a petal from a red peony."
The broken lute. The four or five sticks of wood in the hearth burned softly, giving off a pleasant aroma and lighting up the small room as if it were noon. The gentle smoke did not cause the eyes to smart. It looked like white peony petals billowing in the breeze, flecked now and again with sparks of purple, gold, and crimson. Whenever the fire showed signs of dying down, Yoshino added foot-long strips of kindling from the scuttle. The men were too captivated by the beauty of the flames to ask about the firewood, but eventually Mitsuhiro said,
"What sort of wood are you using? It's not pine."
"No," replied Yoshino. "It's peony wood." They were mildly surprised, for the peony, with its thin, bushy branches, hardly seemed suitable for firewood. Yoshino took a stick that had been only slightly charred and handed it to Mitsuhiro. She told them that the peony stumps in the garden had been planted more than 100 years earlier. At the beginning of winter, the gardeners pruned them very closely, cutting off the worm-eaten upper parts. The trimmings were saved for firewood. Though the quantity was small, it was sufficient for Yoshino. "The peony," remarked Yoshino, "was the king of flowers. Perhaps it was only natural that its withered branches had a quality not to be found in ordinary wood, just as certain men had a worth not displayed by others." "How many men are there," she mused, "whose merit endures after the blossoms have faded and died?" With a melancholy smile, she answered her own question. "We human beings blossom only during our youth, then become dry, odorless skeletons even before we die." A little later, Yoshino said, "I'm sorry I have nothing more to offer you than the sake and the fire, but at least there's wood, enough to last until sunrise."
"You shouldn't apologize. This is a feast fit for a prince."
Shoryu, though accustomed to luxury, was sincere in his praise.
"There is one thing I'd like you to do for me," said Yoshino. "Will you please write a memento of this evening?"
While she was rubbing the inkstone, the girls spread a woolen rug in the next room and laid out several pieces of Chinese writing paper. Being made of bamboo and paper mulberry, it was tough and absorbent, just right for calligraphic inscriptions. Mitsuhiro, assuming the role of host, turned to Takuan and said,
"Good priest, since the lady requests it, will you write something appropriate? Or perhaps we should first ask Koetsu."
Koetsu moved silently on his knees. He took up the brush, thought for a moment, and drew a peony blossom. Above this, Takuan wrote, "Why should I cling to a life so far removed from beauty and passion? Peonies, though lovely, shed their bright petals and die." Takuan's poem was in the Japanese style. Mitsuhiro chose to write in the Chinese manner, setting down lines from a poem by Tsai Wen. "When I am busy, the mountain looks at me. When I am at leisure, I look at the mountain. Though it seems the same, it is not the same, for busyness is inferior to leisure." Under Takuan's poem, Yoshino wrote, "Even as they bloom, a breath of sadness hangs over the flowers. Do they think of the future, when their petals will be gone?" Shoryu and Musashi looked on in silence, the latter greatly relieved when no one insisted that he write something too. They returned to the hearth and chatted for a while, until Shoryu, noticing a biwa, a kind of lute, next to the alcove in the inner room, asked Yoshino to play for them. The others seconded his suggestion. Yoshino, displaying no trace of timidity, took up the instrument and sat down in the middle of the dimly lit inner room. Her manner was not that of a virtuoso proud of her skills, nor did she attempt to be unduly modest. The men cleared their minds of random thoughts, the better to give their attention to her rendition of a section from Tales of the Heike. Soft, gentle tones gave way to a turbulent passage, then to staccato chords. The fire dwindled and the room darkened. Entranced by the music, no one stirred until a tiny explosion of sparks brought them back to earth. As the music ended, Yoshino said with a slight smile, "I'm afraid I didn't play very well." She replaced the lute and returned to the fire. When the men stood up to take their leave, Musashi, happy to be saved from further boredom, was the first to reach the door. Yoshino said farewell to the others one by one, but said nothing to him. As he turned to go, she quietly took hold of his sleeve.
"Musashi, spend the night here. Somehow, I don't want to let you go home."
The face of an importuned virgin couldn't have been redder. He tried to cover up by pretending not to hear, but it was plain to the others that he was too flustered to speak. Turning to Shoyu, Yoshino said,
"It'll be all right if I keep him here, won't it?"
Musashi removed Yoshino's hand from his sleeve.
"No, I'm going with Koetsu."
As he made hastily for the door, Koetsu stopped him.
"Don't be like that, Musashi. Why don't you stay here tonight? You can come back to my house tomorrow. After all, the lady has been kind enough to show her concern for you."
He pointedly went to join the other two men. Musashi's cautiousness warned him that they were deliberately trying to trick him into staying for what laughs they might derive from it later. Still, the seriousness he saw written on the faces of Yoshino and Koetsu argued against its being only a joke. Shoyu and Mitsuhiro, vastly amused by his discomfort, persisted in teasing him, one saying, "You're the most fortunate man in the country," and the other volunteering to stay in his stead. The joking stopped with the arrival of a man Yoshino had sent out to take a look around the quarter. He was breathing heavily, and his teeth were chattering with fright.
"The other gentleman can leave," he said, "but Musashi shouldn't think of it. Only the main gate is open now, and on either side of it, around the Amigasa tea house and along the street, are swarms of samurai, heavily armed, roaming around in small bands. They're from the Yoshioka school. The tradesmen are afraid something awful might happen, so they all closed early. Beyond the quarter, toward the riding ground, I was told there are at least 100 men."
The men were impressed, not only by the report, but by the fact that Yoshino had taken such a precaution. Only Koetsu had any inkling that some incident might have occurred. Yoshino had guessed something was afoot when she saw the spot of blood on Musashi's sleeve.
"Musashi," she said, "now that you've heard what it's like out there, you may be more determined than ever to leave, just to prove you're not afraid. But please don't do anything rash. If your enemies think you're a coward, you can always prove to them tomorrow that you aren't. Tonight, you came here to relax, and it's the mark of a real man to enjoy himself to his heart's content. The Yoshiokas want to kill you. Certainly, it's no disgrace to avoid that. In fact, many people would condemn you for poor judgment if you insisted on walking into their trap. There's the matter of your personal honor, of course, but please stop to consider the trouble a battle would cause to the people in the quarter. Your friends' lives would be endangered, too. Under the circumstances, the only wise thing for you to do is stay here."
Without waiting for his reply, she turned to the other men and said,
"I think it's all right for the rest of you to go, if you're careful along the way."
A couple of hours later, the clock struck 4. The distant sound of music and singing had died out. Musashi was seated on the threshold of the hearthroom, a lonely prisoner waiting for the dawn. Yoshino remained by the fire.
"Aren't you cold there?" she asked. "Do come over here, where it's warm."
"Never mind me. Go to bed. When the sun comes up, I'll let myself out."
The same words had been exchanged quite a number of times already, but to no effect. Despite Musashi's lack of polish, Yoshino was attracted to him. Though it had been said that a woman who thought of men as men rather than as sources of income had no business seeking employment in the gay quarters, this was merely a cliché repeated by the patrons of brothels, men who knew only common prostitutes and had no contact with the great courtesans. Women of Yoshino's breeding and training were quite capable of infatuation. She was only a year or two older than Musashi, but how different they were in their experience of love. Watching him sit so stiffly, restraining his emotions, avoiding her face as though a look at her might blind him, she felt once again like a sheltered maiden experiencing the first pangs of love. The attendants, ignorant of the psychological tension, had spread luxurious pallets fit for the son and daughter of a daimyo in the adjoining room. Little golden bells gleamed softly on the corners of the satin pillows. The sound of snow sliding off the roof was not unlike that of a man jumping down from the fence into the garden. Each time he heard it, Musashi bristled like a hedgehog. His nerves seemed to reach to the very tips of his hair. Yoshino felt a shiver run through her. It was the coldest part of the night, the hour just before dawn, yet her discomfort was not due to the cold. It came from the sight of this fierce man and clashed in an intricate rhythm with her natural attraction to him. The kettle over the fire began to whistle, a cheerful sound that calmed her. Quietly, she poured some tea. "It'll be daylight soon. Have a cup of tea and warm yourself by the fire." "Thank you," said Musashi, without moving. "It's ready now," she said again, and gave up trying. The last thing she wanted to do was make a nuisance of herself. Still, she was slightly offended at seeing the tea go to waste. After it was too cold to drink, she poured it into a small pail kept for that purpose. What is the use, she thought, of offering tea to a rustic like him, for whom the niceties of tea drinking have no meaning? Though his back was to her, she could see that his whole body was as taut as steel armor. Her eyes grew sympathetic.
"Musashi?"
"What?"
"Who are you on guard against?"
"No one. I'm just trying to keep myself from relaxing too much."
"Because of your enemies?"
"Of course."
"In your present state, if you were suddenly attacked in force, you'd be killed immediately. I'm sure of it, and it makes me sad."
He did not answer.
"A woman like myself knows nothing of the art of war, but from watching you tonight, I have the terrible feeling I've seen a man who was about to be cut down. Somehow, there's the shadow of death about you. Is that really safe for a warrior who may at any minute have to face dozens of swords? Can such a man expect to win?"
The question sounded sympathetic, but it unsettled him. He whirled around, moved to the hearth, and sat facing her.
"Are you saying I'm immature?"
"Did I make you angry?"
"Nothing a woman ever said would make me angry. But I am interested in knowing why you think I act like a man who's about to be killed." He was painfully conscious of the web of swords and strategies and maledictions being woven around him by the Yoshioka partisans. He had anticipated an attempt at revenge, and in the courtyard of the Renge-Oin had considered going away to hide. But this would have been rude to Koetsu and would have meant breaking his promise to Rinya. Far more decisive, however, was his desire not to be accused of running away because he was afraid. After returning to the Ogia, he thought he had displayed an admirable degree of composure. Now Yoshino was laughing at his immaturity. This would not have upset him had she been bantering in the fashion of courtesans, but she seemed perfectly serious. He professed not to be angry, but his eyes were as keen as sword tips. He stared straight into her white face. "Explain what you said."
When she did not answer immediately, he said, "Or maybe you were just joking." Her dimples, which had deserted her for a moment, reappeared.
"How can you say that?" she laughed, shaking her head. "Do you think I'd..."